present I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, the antidote to panel games. At the piano is Colin Sell, and your chairman is Humphrey Littleton.
Hello. Hello and welcome to I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue.
So I'm here with Humphrey Littleton, who is chairman of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. He's a jazz trumpeter of legend, national treasure, humorist, calligrapher, and subversive, I think. Congratulations on getting to 30 years with this show.
Thank you very much. I don't know how we've done it, but it's nice to be here.
It's been 30 years. You were there from the very beginning, but you weren't always the host. Is that right?
Well, at the very beginning, I did the pilot. Because in those days, anybody who did any broadcasting, I'd done a bit about music, about jazz and things. Anybody who did any broadcasting and sounded articulate would eventually be called on to do some kind of a pilot, you know. And that's a, you know, a sort of... sample program that people, one hoped, would go out on the air. They never did. 90% of them went down the plug after they'd been done, because producers had a budget to do every year, and if they didn't do enough of them, they cut their budget, so they used to do them in that. And I thought this was one of them. I just went in, you pick up a studio fee, no chance of it coming out, so I went in then did the first one. It was, they tried to do it all ad lib, which meant that I sat there in the middle of four people sweating profusely, you know, because on radio with no time, studio time, to go back and redo an ad lib situation, it was very nerve-wracking. So,
but you'd not been known in radio. You were a jazz man, basically.
Yes.
And so how did it occur to anyone to have you
well,
as the chairman?
I had started a program which is even longer running than this one in 1967, which was a jazz program called The Best of Jazz. And that still goes out on Monday nights. That's been going for 33 years or something. So, they knew that I could talk into a microphone.
Hello and welcome again to I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, the show which does for entertaining panel games what being hit repeatedly on the head with a large croquet mallet does for small frogs. Or so I'm told.
I did the pilot, but when they came through and said we're going to put it on the air, I had already some dates in the book, you know, with my band and so on. So Barry did the first one, I think, of the... he may have done a few more than the first one in the series, and I took it up from then.
You were sustaining a pretty hefty tour schedule throughout all this. Tim and Graham were making the goodies all through the 70s.
Yeah.
When did you find time?
Well, it's not very, very time consuming, because we do we record them two at a time, and now of course we do them in huge theatres. I mean, I think 1400 at Milton Keynes was the biggest, and so that occupies, we do six in the spring, that means three usually Sunday nights, and six more in the late autumn, so that's really only 6 days out of the year. So it doesn't, occupy an enormous amount of time. And the teams usually arrive a day earlier and sort of sort out some things, like the musical games,
right.
You know, and I just stroll in just before the recording goes on, so.
Yeah.
The teams are going to sing for us now in a round called One Song to the Tune of Another. It's a game of such pure simplicity that to offer an explanation would be an insult to the intelligent mind. So, teams, what happens is...
I notice you had a quick kind of read through the cards. Is that about as much preparation as it takes now?
Well, I have to do that because, as John Naismith told the audience tonight, he brought on Ian Pattinson, who for 10 years has written my introductions and the leads into the different games. And some people say, oh, we thought it was you. No, that's not so much. But in point of fact, for me, it's a bigger challenge. It's much harder to do and much more rewarding to do well than just to think up some stuff of your own, you know, hit or miss. Because you've got to see to it that you don't torpedo any of his punchlines. And therefore, you have to think about it, think about the timing and judge it correctly, so that, for instance, a good joke doesn't disappear in laughter or applause or anything like that.
Okay, so I thought I was slightly modest because, although a good portion is written down, there do seem to be these occasional ad libs which basically bring their house down.
Well, it's all part of my persona on the programme of a grumpy chairman. When I first did the first real show, not the pilot, I drove in thinking, what am I going to do? I've got four, you know, professional comedians, comic actors, I can't do it. I can't chip in with anything worth chipping in. And by the time I got to the theatre, I thought, well, that is exactly how I shall present myself, as somebody who's come in the midst of all these people. And there's a slight hint that he doesn't really want to be there. And a bit slightly grumpy about everything, and I've done that 30 years now.
Okay, the teams are going to sing for us now in a game called One Song to the Tune of Another. You'd have to be lacking even a basic knowledge of harmony and rhythm to fail to grasp this concept. So listen up, Jeremy. A song is comprised of two main constituents, the words and the tune, a bit like a bottle of shampoo and conditioner, in fact. The shampoo element can be envisaged as the words, cleaning the grease and grime from our hair, although obviously the words of a song don't literally do that. This is supported by the conditioner, leaving our locks shiny and manageable and eliminating unsightly split ends, in the same way that the tune supports the words, except that words don't suffer from split ends. Now, teams, I can see you've grasped the basics already, but yes, there is one question that still needs an answer. What about dandruff? Well, even the best quality shampoo and conditioner won't always guarantee to rid us of an unsightly irritant that keeps coming back no matter how hard you try. At the piano, Colin Sell.
On the subject of ageism, is it true that I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, was going to go to television, but you were all deemed too old for television?
Well, I'm sorry to say, it's a regrettable fact that, 45 years old, we were a bit older than that, but it didn't make much difference. 45 years old is usually a sort of a watershed, you know, beyond which in television, they're always wanting young people to come in and do things. But I didn't want to do it. Willie Rushton and I held out, I think, more strongly against television. Because, as Willie said at one of the meetings that we had about doing a television thing, this is, though we say it ourselves, it'll go down as one of the great BBC comedy shows that people will talk about, you know, like Round the Horn and Itmar and all those things. And why, you know, move into a different medium, which is, apart from anything else, going to be very hard to do. You know, you can't have... One of the things we do very often is to play television games, but on radio. And things like we've done Through the Keyhole, and we do children's party games, Pass the Parcel, and all these things which are essentially visual things.
And the blinking game.
And the blinking game, which we do, which nobody listening at home can see what's going on. But you can't do that on television. And also television, it's a lot of hanging about and a lot of running through things. And then we just turn up and, virtually speaking, you know, we just come on and do it. And it has a sort of freshness.
And looking at your audience tonight, you've got families, you've got young and old, you've got a rather well-heeled looking
crowd here. A very wide sort of range of people that we get for this show, and I know that because my audiences have improved in character since the show became, as it has been for the last decade, I suppose, a sort of like a culture, especially among young people. And I get people who come to my concerts, and they come up, and I expect they're going to, I expect them to ask for a request of a jazz number in the second half, and they say, "Oh, we're nephews and nieces of Mrs. Trellis," or in fact, sometimes they come up and say, "I'm Mrs. Trellis."
Did Radiohead come up and say that? You played on a Radiohead.
That's right. Yes, I did. I did. I started on the sort of fringes of journalism when I was a cartoonist on the Daily Mail. I used to write things, and I learned very early on that sort of journalistic principle of say yes and find out about it afterwards.
Okay, but there must have been some... I mean, if they wanted a trumpeter, a session trumpeter for a track, they probably could have... found one fairly easily, but there must have been some love in that.
Yeah, but the thing was that Johnny Greenwood, who is the sort of that guy who does the talking, he wrote to me and said, "This is probably an awful cheek, but we've got a track on our forthcoming CD which we're having terrible trouble about how to treat it. And we discussed it the other day and thought that maybe... the sort of New Orleans-y jazz that they'd heard some of my early records. So, what do you think about it?" So I said yes, in that true journalistic fashion, and then send me a tape of the tune. Couldn't make head or tail of it, and this is where the find out about it after, say yes first and regret it later. But we had a meeting up at the BBC, and I said, sort of half-jokingly, I said, "It sounds to me as though the sort of thing that might go would be New Orleans funeral music. Because, as you know, it's not Happy Days Are Here Again when they perform." And he said, "Yeah, it's a great idea." So we went in a studio and spent, I think it was 9 hours or 7 hours, gradually moving. They didn't know what they wanted us to do. We didn't know what they wanted us to do. And we gradually sort of moved towards it. And after 7 hours, I said, "That's it. It's not going to get any better than that." But there's a certain sort of, working with Radiohead had a certain, sorry, I haven't a clue, element, unexpected element about it, because Tom York, the singer, who's he writes wonderful things, that sort of always reminded me of that Procol Harum thing, the surrealistic words, and his are far out and great, and like when they came to us, we had to play the tape over and over and over, and I began to get the feeling of what he was on about, without ever, it's abstract, the concept of his lyrics and that.
Do you think that "I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue" is the best advert against equal opportunities there's ever been, since it seems to be mostly a boys' club?
What do you mean from the point of view of the people, the teams, and all that sort of thing?
The panel, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, I would have said the opposite, because I have nothing to do with. I mean, I turn up and do my bit. I'm not in on any production discussions, like, for instance, Graham Garden and Tim Brooke Taylor are. But the teams, especially since Willie Rushton died, but sometimes before when somebody was on a tour somewhere and couldn't do it, the teams themselves always choose people to be on. And we've had a lot of the young comedians on. One who immediately comes to mind is Phil Jupitus, who enjoyed himself, enormously. He made a little speech at the end saying how he'd listened to the program for years. And it was the best,
He was in the crowd tonight, in the front row.
So I was going to see him backstage. Yeah. So the young element does come into it.
There's always been that sort of cheeky innuendo in the show, particularly with Samantha and etc. But it never crosses a line. I've found is it remains innuendo, but never sort of spills into.
Well, to tell you the honest truth, I don't really understand what any of them are getting at. I'm very surprised when I'm reading out an ordinary bit of information from the script and the audience suddenly bursts out laughing. So, no, it all goes over my head.
So that's the secret. Not to understand.
Well, the secret of it is to read what you've got in front of you. Don't, if you suspect that something has a double meaning, don't pause, don't put on a sort of leery vocal expression, if you know what I mean, on radio. Don't sort of do anything other than just read it. And if people see something rude in it, well, very few of them write into the BBC, because to do so, they would confess that they saw something rude in it, you see, so they don't do it. I just read it out.
On that subject,
that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I was going to ask, you've probably answered this, but is it difficult to find younger comics to come on who know the boundaries? But maybe there aren't any boundaries.
It doesn't seem to be, because I can't remember all the people. We've had Jeremy Hardy on, and we've had, of course, Stephen. We've had Paul Merton on as well. A very funny lady who's on the news quiz, and again, whose name has completely gone out of my mind, but she was marvellous. Oh, we've had Sandy Toksvig as well. So there's nothing, there's nothing sexist or ageist or anything else about it.
Gives me great pleasure to welcome our regular teams of, on my right, Willie Rushton and Tim Brooke-Taylor. And on my left, Barry Cryer and Graham Garden.
I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue is 30 years old this week. How comes it's lasted so long?
It started in 1972. That would do it.
If I was to be serious, I think the main thing, which is Humphrey Littleton, is it's one of those voices. He's funny, he's absolutely filthy. But not filthy, brilliant writing by Ian Paterson. Willie Rushton, the really sad thing about his anniversary is that Willie Rushton's not here, because he's such an integral part of it. And I had a chat with him actually a week before he died, and we said, when will this ever finish? And he said, well, it can go on as long as Hump's around. And I think that's what we feel now.
Yeah.
Graham, you devised the show, and it's been said that the inspiration was greed and laziness. Can you explain?
Well, that's quite true, yeah.
Very good reason.
Extremely good.
What better? Yes.
We'd been doing I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again on the radio, and Bill Oddie and I had been writing most of the scripts, and we discovered that we were paid more for writing scripts on television, and it was not quite such hard work as writing for radio. So I came up with the idea, because I'd done a panel game, and I'd been a guest on a panel game, and thought, this is quite easy, really. And all you do is you give people a set of rules and then hope that they're funny, and then you just broadcast the funny bits. So we made up between myself and David Hatch, this sort of panel game with apparently serious rounds.
Do you remember who picked the theme music?
David Hatch, I think, picked it. He played it to me in his office and said, what about this? And I thought, that's totally inappropriate. That'll do.
There's another reason I remember you doing it, because you'd been on a panel show with Giles Bangas, and you said, God, this is easy.
This is money for old rope.
Let's get a bit of that money, and we'll provide the old rope, won't
we? Yeah. Well, we nearly called it old rope.
Unfortunately, we didn't get the money.
The music's a piece of music called The Shickle Shamble.
Right.
Or anoraks out there.
Monte Carlo or Bust,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's finish off with a round of limericks. Here's one for you, Barry. When travelling in Holland by bike.
When travelling in Holland by bike, something happened that I didn't like.
I had a mishap.
When I hit a Dutch cap.
and my finger got stuck in a dike.
And there was going to be a TV version of Clue, but you were deemed too old for television, really.
Well, we did a pilot, or BBC weren't interested, naturally. So we did a pilot for ITV, and everybody seemed to like it. We didn't get it quite right, but it was going in the right direction, and it went to the central area where they decided to put on. They said, yes, great programme, but could we have some younger people in it? Actually, the programme doesn't really exist at all, does it, without whatever age the people are on it. It took Humph out, that would be the heart of it.
Yeah. Can I apologise for hogging this?
Yes, you can.
I apologise for hogging this.
I'll direct something at you now.
But I think we were hopefully a missile. At the back of all our minds, I think, was the worry that it is such a radio programme. I mean, it really exists on radio and works on radio and is about radio. But putting it on television might somehow take away from its myth.
Yeah, that's true.
Might spoil the radio show. So we were never 100% about going.
I was 100%. I was 100%. As long as you kept going on radio as a
entity. I agree.
That was pure greed, though.
Willie was ambivalent, as I remember.
Yeah.
Sort of bolt fast at one point.
No, I would actually quite like to have done it in a way, because then you could have done more for some visual jokes, which you can't do on radio. So it would have been, there would have been an extra element. And we started to try and put those in the pilot, didn't we? And not many of them worked, because they technically wouldn't work.
As the language is constantly changing, I'd like the teams to provide some new definitions they may have spotted lately.
Polyunsaturated, a dry parrot.
Barry.
Hors d'oeuvre. Women who hang round diesel pumps.
Graham.
Carpentry, a way in for ornamental fish.
Pokemon. A Jamaican proctologist.
Stucco. Hitherto unknown Marx brother.
Gripe. What Australians make wine from.
Extemporary. Permanent.
Loophole, a very long lavatory brush. Hot pot, stolen drugs.
Hormone. No, forget it.
The internet's allowing a lot of people to play Mornington Crescent online. Is that how it should be played, or do you need eye contact?
I would think eye contact myself.
Yeah, it's a bit like poker in that sense. It's better.
If it's the only way you can get to play it, it's fine.
But it does bring a sort of international dimension to it.
But as he was saying, if you can't really see the other person, you can't play absolutely properly. But that doesn't, as Graham says, it doesn't stop doing it. Well, there could be a board game, and it's not as good, but it would be worth doing properly.
Now, I'd like to ask you if you'll play a special round of Cheddar Gorge on the subject of Samantha. Tim, can you start?
I'm working in that direction.
In that direction.
Hold position first.
I
was
once
in
the
BBC
looking
for
a
very
rare
but
strangely
intriguing
and
probably
hitherto undiscovered
version
of Samantha.
But
I
found
that she
was
not
to
be
seen
in
any
other
portion
of
the
BBC
except once
I
went
to
the
smallest
room
in
the BBC,
and
there
I
saw
none
other
than
Samantha
and
her
very close, intimate friend who was none other than the very same person who was sitting next to me.
Full stop. I think that's quite
enough. I think that paints a picture.
Can we talk quickly about your careers outside I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue? Barry, you've written for such comics as Kenny Everett.
I've written to a lot of famous comedians as well.
Morecambe and Wise?
Yes.
Ooh.
What sort of noises do we have to make?
Just
can you do farmyard?
What?
A day in the farmyard.
What?
Oh, and over there's James Cagney.
Kenny Everett, Morecambe and Wise, Bruce
yes.
Forsyth.
Yes.
Yes. Tommy Cooper.
Yes.
Stanley Baxter.
Yes.
Dick Emery.
Yes.
Dave Allen.
Yes.
Frankie Howard.
Yes.
Bob Hope.
Yes.
Jack Benny.
Yes.
Richard Pryor.
Yes.
Incredible.
On one occasion.
Charles Dickens.
Charles Dickens.
You wrote for Charles.
Anthony Trollope. What a pain he was.
Tim, it says here you've worked on Me and My Girl with Richard O'Sullivan and has also worked alongside Roland Ratt.
I have, yes.
Was that a great honour?
That was a great honour. And also, what's the name of the original page three girl? You know who I mean. Anyway, she was together, three of us together. And Graham and I wrote for Orson Welles.
I read that. I deliberately left that out, though, because it's...
Because it's not funny after Roland Ratt.
Roland Ratt is...
By Milligan, I used to write for. You see, I liked Roland Ratt. I thought it was good, you know.
Yeah.
Best thing the director general did for Paul.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. People said, oh, the man that brought Roland Ratt.
Yes. Graham, a scientific question for you, so listen carefully. What happens exactly when Eric eats a banana?
When Eric eats a banana, he turns into Banana Man, I'm afraid. Ask Tim. Tim was involved.
Yes.
He's not entirely innocent.
I was Eric, and I did eat that Banana Man, and I turned into Graham, who was Banana Man, which actually I saw one the other day. Rather good.
Still going strong.
Yeah,
very
popular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Picture round now.
Picture
round.
First picture for Barry. Does that evoke any memories for you?
Yes, that was me and Johnny Vegas in The Weakest Link. We were the head-to-head finalists.
Did you win?
What? No, Johnny got it. Johnny got it. I was just allowed to, by the younger ones
what
to stay.
This? What was this?
Weakest Link.
Why on earth did you go on that?
Why on earth did I go on it?
Yeah.
I was asked to go on
vanity.
It. And it was charity. It was for charity, you see.
No excuse.
I do a lot of charity
does
work.
There's a lot of work for vanity.
I do a lot of charity work.
It's the dominatrix you like.
Oh, yes. It,
Mr.
She
Whitlatt.
Does stir your... She does
winks,
stir
she
your loins.
I flee to the country.
Johnny got...
Why has Johnny Vegas got Mr. Spock ears on?
Yeah. Well, it was a comedian's edition.
Ah.
And I'm wearing a wig to make myself look older. And it was quite an afternoon, actually.
Yeah?
A comedian's edition?
Yes, comedian's edition.
Johnny Vegas?
Yeah, but light and shade, and I was on as well. I'm cultivating a new act!
Graham, a probably slightly less interesting one for you.
Oh.
You said it.
Amongst the teeth. What's going on there?
That's right. Gosh, yes, that's Body Matters, which I used to co-present with Gillian Rice and Helen Marianne Davis. And we took a trip around the human body.
Where did you end up?
Well, we started there in the mouth. So.
Right.
Right.
Fair enough.
Leave the rest of it up to you.
Yes.
When we did the nose, we had Kenneth Williams sliding out of an enormous human nose. And they wouldn't let me.
They wouldn't let me
say, "Here comes the bogeyman."
But you're even saying that.
Yeah.
Did the nostrils flare when he came out?
Do being a doctor? Mm. Do any of the other panelists come to you with their twinges?
No, I'm pleased to say they don't. They wouldn't trust me, for goodness sake.
No.
You can't have an old friend as a doctor.
Actually, no. Graham's very good at not actually treating us, but saying either go to the hospital or not. That's about as far as it goes.
Oh, he just says, don't do that to me.
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Tim.
Oh, hello. I thought I was getting out of this.
Your picture.
Oh, yes. What's Graham doing in it?
This is pretty obscure, that.
This was the in-betweeners, wasn't it?
It must have been. Yeah. So the popular song we did in the 70s, reached number 7 in the hit parade, called The In-Betweeners, and that was the cloaks over the top to the costume. It was a costume, split costume, that one side was old fogey and the other side was glitter. And that's really what it is. I think we were probably on some very embarrassing programme.
Because when you're on Blue Peter,
quite possibly.
Did all the pop shows.
Yeah, Crackerjack.
Crackerjack.
It's true. It's the way we got on to Top of the Pops. We agreed to do Crackerjack. That's right.
Is it conceivable that there could be more goodies? And I don't leave Barry out of this because you've popped up in a few episodes as well.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Bless him. Well, we're personal here. Have a word with Jane Root, who is head of BBC Two, and she keeps consistently saying, no, I won't have them on. So.
Right. Well, we'll start an email.
Yeah.
Well, you probably remember the goodies was 30 years old last year. And you remember the celebrations, the street parties.
And 30 years ago, we won Silver Rose in Montreux.
That's right.
Yes, Kim Kong. And funny enough, we seem to get sort of passionate people now about it, because I went to Australia for a goodies convention last year where they've gone on showing it, and all the people there were in their 20s and 30s, which of course is the audience that the BBC desperately wants to get on board. So.
This is how Humph describes you. See if you agree with what he says. Prone to argue with the chairman, slightly vulnerable, perspires a lot, a favourite with the crowd, people hiss when I'm cruel to him, said Humph.
Yes, I think none of it's true except the bit about perspiring a lot. I do that, I have to say. I'll accept that. I'm very pleased with that. Move on.
Barry, Humph describes you thus. The gag man. There are no embarrassing silences, thanks to you.
Embarrassing noises, but not silences.
Bottomless pit of one-liners, able to come up with gags at a second's notice, provides the bricks and mortar. It's kind of nice, isn't it?
And they let me appear in it sometimes as well. I bring my wheelbarrow in.
Very good on plumbing.
That's very gracious of him, and particularly about my quick wits.
Anyway, what would he know?
And Graham, you're described, bides his time, picks his moment, a punchline man supreme, very dry, often has the perfect punchline, which helps Humph to end the round on a high note.
Helps him, eh? Very dry as opposed to the rather sweaty me, is that what he said?
Was that Humph who said that?
Yes.
Ah. So I helped.
I detected Graham's style in that.
I sort of put a stop to the fun, basically, is what he's saying.
Yeah, but you bide your time.
Humph's very modest about his own comic abilities. What do you think his particular gifts are?
He's very arrogant, Alf. He would be modest with you. He's overbearing and quite
ruthless. I was a fan of his when I was a teenager. I used to go and listen to his band, which still plays magnificently. And I still get a thrill out of working with Humph. It's extraordinary after these years. And he's such an incredibly nice man, isn't he?
Very.
And very bright man. And he is modest, but he shouldn't be, because I think he's quite fantastic.
I still think it's him.
And how much of his stuff is written and how much is that?
Well, he is capable of writing everything, but Ian Paterson basically writes his script now, and I think Ian would say that the great thing is you're writing for a great man, and there's nothing worse for a writer than to write something that's delivered badly. Ian writes some good stuff, and Humph makes it even better, which is the perfect for a writer.
Yeah, absolutely. And Humph does it, obviously, in the nature of the show. It's not all scripted. Humph reads his links, and then we play the games, and Humph's interjections are his own, and very often they're showstoppers as well. So he is an extremely funny man. I don't think he knows how funny he is or how he is funny, which is probably a good thing. He just does it.
He's in a great tradition, like Kenneth Horne was in Round the Horn, sort of the urbane man in the middle with all the idiots milling about, and he's never quite sure what's going on but just wants to get it over.
And the seeming innocence allows him to be absolutely filthy, which is, Humph can't have said that, can he? And of course everything he says is du grand entendre anyway, so he hasn't said anything filthy, and he looks really genuinely surprised if the audience laughs. But as Graham says, he can ad-lib the one we recorded on Sunday. It was something your handwriting so bad I had to pin it up and run past it to read it. I still don't quite know what it means, but it made me laugh immoderately.
The programme consultant was Ian Patterson, and the producer was John Naismith.
John, how did you first come to the show?
In 1991 it was.
In his grandmother's will, in fact.
Did you make any changes to the format?
There was certain, I mean, you know, every new producer has an idea, I think, of the strengths and weaknesses of the show. It was not a show that I'd sort of consciously listened to a great deal, so I suppose I came to it sort of quite fresh and perhaps sort of relatively objectively. I think there were certain rounds that I thought maybe had been a little bit past their sell-by date. Previous producers had kept quite a good archive of past rounds, so I was able to sort of go through them initially. And I also had an exercise swiftly after taking over the show. I was asked by the Worldwide to compile an audio cassette. I thought I'd do a compilation of past programmes. So I basically listened to... Well, I phoned up the teams first to say, could they suggest any good rounds for the tape? And they said, I can't remember any. I couldn't remember any highlights from any of the show. So I listened to every single tape in the archive. It was about, I must say, 150 programmes or something.
And then you found a highlight.
And then I found a highlight. I found quite a few actually, and they're on the first tape.
Ian, what's your first memory of coming to I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue?
Well, in the non-professional sense, that's when I started writing. Now, in the non-professional sense, I came to the Clue when it started. As a, you know, I used to listen to it in the 70s when I was in the real world doing a real job, and never thinking that. Some 20 years later, I'm actually working with the guys and writing on the show, which is a bit of a tragic end to a young person's career, I know, but it is. But yeah, I mean, as John describes, Bob Fraser-Steele and I were writing the news quiz at the time, and the BBC, in its wisdom, sacked our producer, very sensibly, in my opinion, and then noticed at the beginning of the next series they didn't have a producer, not so sensibly. They decided to let John have a crack at it. Only I think the two shows were in production at the same time, or overlapped or something, which meant that John had been writing the links, and some very good ones too, I thought, I have to say, but that's not necessarily a producer's job, especially since it takes the bread out of the mouths of writers who have slaved years and done their apprenticeship for this, only some amateur to make pathetic attempts at writing a few knob gags in his spare time.
Okay, teams, to assist Stephen, you'll be performing these songs as duets. I think that's right. I can't read my producer's writing. The worst writing I've ever seen in my life. The only way to read it is pin it up on a board and run past it.
It's a credit to all of you, really, that it's gotten funnier as time's gone on.
How sweet of you to notice.
How very, perceptive of you to notice, I'd like to say. I think a bit of what, obviously, as far as I'm concerned, is obviously the main stuff I did to write for Humph. Humph wasn't, in my opinion, doing enough. Because, not because he's lazy, simply because he wasn't being given stuff to do. And I don't think anyone had ever considered that the point of having the chairman there was to do a sort of 10-minute stand-up act in between all the rounds. But in that, virtually, if you gave him the Argos catalogue, he could read it and make it funny. So it's not such an onerous task. But you just think, yeah, I can hear him doing this. And occasionally I write a link, and I think, well, that link's easily long enough. And I think there's another gag there. Would be nice to hear him do it. And, oh, hang on, there's a topper that could go with that. Well, I'll put it in anyway. We can always cut it out. But I do occasionally feel a bit sorry for the other guys, Tim and the rest of them, have to sit there while he grinds his way through a couple of pages of old rubbish I've been churning out the night before.
The lines sometimes get pretty near the knuckle.
So not with you.
I'm talking about innuendo.
You mean knob gags?
I mean knob gags.
Oh, no, there is no rudery at all. The words on the page are completely innocent.
Humph actually said the secret to his delivery is that he doesn't actually understand the joke.
He does read it as if he doesn't get the joke, but he obviously does. But he has got that fantastic knack of genuinely looking as if it's the first time he's read it. Quite often it sounds like the first time he's read it as well, but no, he really does have that ability to just pick it off the page as if he were, like, you know, reading a shopping list, something you might casually glance down for.
I don't think there's any better deliverer of a line, or a chairman of any other panel game, and I seem to have worked at almost, yeah. So is Ian.
That's why we got rid of Olivier. I mean, Olivier was just hopeless. He couldn't read a line to save his life, could he?
Obviously, I'm talking about obviously the chairman of panel games. Compare radio and television panel games, there are few people that can get sort of laughs and rounds of applause before they've even introduced the teams. I don't know what the percentage of it's sort of 50% lines and 50% delivery, but. Ian has, because I've worked with him quite a lot in other ventures, both on radio and television, and it's not been completely unknown for some of the lines that Humphrey has delivered to have been used again for other performers, and I have to say that they haven't gone down nearly as well.
Has anyone ever phoned up from on high and said, I can't believe Humph has just said that?
I have sometimes get... emails of praise from fellow producers, astonished that some line could have been delivered. Well, I got that with a Samantha line. Was it Italian? Some sort of Italian thing that she?
That was nice. That was nice cream. Yeah, nice cream thing.
Yes, she'd.
She was going to spend the evening licking the nuts off a large
Neapolitan. Yes,
and I really don't see. Where the joke is in that? I mean, yeah. She was simply going out.
It's an ice cream, isn't it?
It's an ice cream that has
with pistachio nuts on the top.
Has nuts on it. Yes.
She was licking. Yeah. As one does.
Yeah.
Licking the nuts.
She wasn't going to commit a sexual act on an Italian.
Yes.
I mean, that's just ludicrous to think that.
Yes. Also,
fat or otherwise.
When the dog breeders, didn't she go to the park with a German shepherd?
No, I think it was time to let her whip it out.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
All right.
So it's been 30 years. Any thoughts on how it's lasted and why it's still so popular?
Ian? Probably idleness on the part of the schedulers and their inability, seriously, their inability to come up with anything that could be better to replace it. It's a very good show with very good people on it. It's as simple as that. And it hasn't got lazy. I mean, there are plenty of rounds that used to be done which aren't done anymore. There are new rounds that have come in and gone fairly quickly. There are some one or two rounds which we've done which only ever appeared once and got fantastic laughs at the time. And yet, other shows would probably do that again, if not every week, adding tonight. That's not been the case. And it's also got in the panellists... sadly no longer with Willie, but certainly with a choice of some of the best guest comedians in the country. With those four people sat there, you have got some of the best talent there is in the country, and the diverse talents as well. I mean, they come from various different schools, partly comprehensive, part public, obviously. Did I tell you about going to the dentist the other week? I was completely lost, I'm sorry. But there's a fantastic diversity, which means that you don't have to do it. So if you watch an awful lot of TV comedy panel games, you could swap all the people around from seat to seat and not really notice any difference. I mean, their material is much the same. If you switched the set, if you turned away from the set and just listened to it, you'd have trouble telling who was delivering which line and which joke. But there's not that problem with Clue, because each individual does have his own style, and it all adds together like some kind of bizarre oral jigsaw that sort of melds together to make something a bit bigger, I think. And have I won my award for being pretentious prat yet?
It's a tremendous show, Tim. That's why it's lasted. And it combines every form of humour. Satire, nonsense, impressions, singing. It's even got a pianist.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous, tremendous show.
like Graham Garden, Sandy Coxvig and Timbrooke Taylor were being given silly things to do by Humphrey Littleton, with Colin Sell setting some of them to music.
So I'm here with Colin Sell, famously the pianist on I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. Does it seem like 30 years, and were you there from the very beginning?
It sort of takes me by surprise, actually, that yes, it's been going 30 years. I joined it, I think, 28 years ago. I didn't do the pilot, and I didn't do the first series. And then I joined it, and the reason I joined it was because the very young producer, the very good producer, who'd been asked to take it over, was a chap called Simon Brett, who, of course, has gone on to do lots of other things, writing books and plays and heaven knows what else. But he'd seen me do stuff up at the Edinburgh Fringe, and he just took a complete chance on me and said, I've been given this new programme to do, and I've heard you play, and I've heard you write music, and you improvise, and you can kind of cope with those things that people sort of throw at you musically. Would you like to do it? So that was back in 1974. I was in short trousers, of course, then. You know, I was a child prodigy, really. And it was, it took me a long time to get used to it, because I was working, and I still am working, with people who were sort of my icons, really. You know, when I was a teenager, I was watching The Goodies, yeah. And there was Barry Cryer and Humphrey Littleton playing jazz and all that, you know. And Willie Rushton, of course, was an enormous name, in the 60s. He made his name, really, doing That Was the Week That Was, and so on. So suddenly I was working with these people, and so for about 10 years I kept thinking they're never going to ask me back. They never asked me back, you know, I'm sure they won't. And gradually, over a period of time, I've become, which is very nice to me, I've become part of the setup, you know.
Yeah.
I don't do much in the programme, it has to be said. If you actually analyse it, I don't do a great deal, but I get a kind of reflected glory from it, which is nice.
Yes, yeah. And there's a certain relationship, on stage at least, between you and Humph.
Yes, yes.
Which people enjoy.
They do, and we get on very well, but it's good fun to play that sort of, he's antagonistic towards me, I just sit and smile blithely at him.
It was back in 1972 that Colin first started to learn the piano Within 2 or 3 weeks, he could manage to tap out a few basic tunes with one finger. Obviously, his later career never fulfilled that early promise.
And I don't have a microphone in front of me, so if I want to make any comments, I'll have to really shout. So you get this sort of disembodied voice in the background, which Humph always likes to play off and make rude remarks about them and so on.
So, have you ever got together with Humph as pianist and trumpeter?
Only a couple of occasions when we've done Christmas shows. He's had his trumpet there, and we've done the Christmas specials, and he's played Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and we've worked then with his bass player and drummer as well. And there was a book launch we did some time ago, 2 or 3 years back at Pizza Express, and we had a quartet then. There was Humph and me, and again his bass player and drummer, and we did quite a lot of jazz playing, which is very jolly. But no, we don't. Apart from these odd occasions, we don't work together musically. You know, very jolly we did. The only thing is that many years ago, I was asked to do the music for a radio version of Look Back in Anger, and Jimmy Porter, Look Back in Anger, plays the trumpet. And so somebody said to me, well, why don't you get Humphrey Littleton to come and play it? And it was a very good idea. So it was kind of sort of revenge, really, for all the times that Humphrey Littleton had been rude to me in the programme. We had a good laugh about it, because I was actually getting him to come into the studio and play my music and do sort of what I told him. Because it was smashing. We had a wonderful time. It was great. Yeah. He did a very good version of what the sort of trumpet playing that Jimmy Porter would have done.
Piano accompaniment will be provided by Colin Sell, who, as far as we can make out, has never had to go through any kind of checks. Actually, we were interested to hear that Colin was responsible for bringing the Beatles to Abbey Road. Camden Council have just sent him the pest controller's bill for fumigating the entire block.
There's a huge love for the show across the country, and Humph recently played trumpet on a Radiohead.
He did, yes.
Are you ever, as an icon of this show, asked to make guest appearances and stuff like that?
I have occasionally, yes. I mean, I've been involved with it with the odd band. I've been asked to do perhaps the odd bit of sort of cabaret playing or cocktail playing, something like that, because people, you know, regardless of whatever talent I may have, people associate me with the show, which is nice. So, yes, there are little spin-offs like that occasionally, yes. But what's interesting is that nobody knows what I look like, because there's only ever been one photograph of me published by the Radio Times, and so nobody knows what I look like. So I don't get people stopping me in the street and saying, oh, you're Colin Sell, you know, which is a bit of a relief in a way, really, because I think sometimes people, you know, rather suffer for their being in the public eye, you know.
Okay. Well, we'll put you on the website.
Yes. A little terrifying.
I'm afraid that maybe no one will see it there either.
You shouldn't say that.
Any favourite memories of the last 30 years?
I do. I mean, I always enjoy doing the programme. I mean, we all miss Willie. I think there's two things, really. One is a specific moment, actually, when I was accompanying Willie Rushton, and he was just doing what he always did, was like, he did his own thing, you know, and he just called out to me halfway through singing. He said, "Keep up, piano," he said, which the audience found very funny, and I did as well, because he was just making it really difficult for me to follow. But I think the other thing, it isn't so much a memory, it's just a feeling about the programme, is that what is very rewarding is that so many younger people come into it and perform in it and love doing it, and they fit in perfectly well. It's not as if it's just older comedians and somehow shutting out the young ones. I mean, you know, it's great to have, you know, the sort of, we've had, you know, Tony Hawks and Jeremy Hardy and Sandy Toksvig and so on and so forth, and I dare say we could have even younger people if we wanted. We could probably, you know, I don't know, people of the sort of the Mark Thomas generation, and the reason I say that is because apart from doing bits of music and so on and so forth, I also run the Music at East 15 Acting School. And I found over recent years that there are more and more young people now who listen to Radio 4. Yeah. And therefore I have a lot of students who actually know the programme. Whereas once upon a time, when I was teaching back, say, you know, back in, until about the middle of the 90s, really, young people weren't regular Radio 4 listeners, and therefore they didn't associate my name with any sort of silly radio programmes, and therefore this was a whole completely different story, you know. So it's nice. We obviously are reaching out. And if you look at the audience we had tonight at the you know, the 30th anniversary show, the Players Theatre, it's a pretty mixed audience of in ages, which is very nice. It isn't just the sort of people of our age.
Families, as well as a lot of a couple of famous faces here, and Judy Dench.
Indeed, yes. And, who's been on the programme, but she's actually been in it. But I've got some friends in tonight who were, you know, students and so on, and they just were begging for tickets, you know. Yeah. So that's nice. That's nice that it's spreading, you know.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, as the plastic cup of time fails to emerge from the vending machine of destiny, and the scalding coffee substitute of fate splashes onto the unsuspecting crotch of eternity, I notice it's the end of the show, and indeed the series. But our regular teams will be back again in the spring, and what would the show be? What would the show be like without four top-class comedians? Tune in next year to find out. So, from Samantha, the teams, myself, and the fine folk of High Wycombe, it's goodbye.
Barry Cryer, Graham Garvin, Jeremy Hardy and Tim Brooke Taylor were being given silly things to do by Humphrey Lyttelton, with Colin Sell setting some of them to music. The programme consultant was Ian Pattinson, and the producer was John Naismith.